It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Let's get the latest now on the uproar surrounding phone hacking within Rupert Murdoch's media empire. The scandal has now reached the highest echelons of the British police. And over the weekend, it claimed the job of the head of Scotland Yard. That's the country's most senior policeman. We're joined from London now by NPR's Philip Reeves to talk about what's happened. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning.
So why did the head of Scotland Yard resign?
Well, this is a gentleman called Sir Paul Stevenson, and it's all about the relationship at a senior level between his force, the London Metropolitan Police, and Rupert Murdoch's News of the World. There have long been allegations this relationship got out of hand and that the two became far too close. Now it's emerged that Stevenson's force hired a former News of the World deputy editor as an advisor from 2009 to 2010. That same journalist, a guy called Neil Wallace, was arrested a couple of days ago. Wallace was working at the News of the World at the time the hacking took place. Very embarrassing for the police. The underlying general question is, did this relationship, this cosy relationship between the police and News International, the owners of the News of the World, affect the way the police handled allegations that journalists were hacking into people's voicemail? Was this one of the reasons that the police declined to open their original, very perfunctory first inquiry?
Is it clear, Phil, whether Stevenson is admitting personal fault here, or is this a case where he's saying the buck stops with me?
He says he's actually leaving the job with his integrity intact. But there is another complication. It emerged over the weekend that he accepted a freebie at a health spa, and that Neil Wallace, the News of the World deputy editor I mentioned a moment ago, did PR work for that spa. Stevenson says this has nothing to do with Wallace and that he obeyed all the rules and he declared this stay at the spa as a gift officially and so on. But that is feeding into the mix and complicating the issue.
Now, meanwhile, this is, of course, a huge political brouhaha. Lots of questions being raised about how the Prime Minister, David Cameron, is handling all of this.
Yes, they are. There are many questions, and among the people raising them is, in fact, Stevenson. In his resignation speech yesterday, Stevenson drew attention to the fact that Cameron also, for a while, had a News of the World man working for him, the former editor, no less, Andy Coulson, and he was his communications chief. Coulson's also since been arrested. Stevenson seemed to be saying that he, Stevenson, had accepted responsibility and fallen on his sword for employing a News of the World man as he did. But what had the Prime Minister done? Now, Cameron's in South Africa today, and he's been fighting back. He's saying there's no comparison between his relationship with Coulson and the police hiring someone who turns out to be involved in alleged crimes that they, the police, are supposed to be investigating.
I mean, lots of names to try to keep straight here. Lots of arrests that we're hearing about. More every day, it seems. Bottom line is, this has become just a huge scandal, reaching all layers of British politics, media, society, police, everything.
That's true, and it's going to run and run. And I think it's adding to this sense that people in authority have lost their way. And it's a kind of a sense that the establishment is now appearing in political debate quite regularly, need to be brought to book. Remember, this is coming on the heels of the banking crisis, and people blame bankers for their recklessness and their greed and their continuing acceptance of big bonuses, and a scandal here over MPs, parliamentarians, fiddling their expenses.
Before we let you go, Phil, we want to get up to speed on Rebecca Brooks and what's happening with her. She was, of course, until late last week, the chief executive in charge of Rupert Murdoch's newspapers in Britain. She was arrested over the weekend. She's now out on bail. Lots of questions about what happens next for her, whether she'll be able to testify in front of the parliamentary inquiry that's investigating all these charges.
Well, not long ago, her lawyer spoke on her behalf, saying she's not guilty of any criminal offence. He says that the police interviewed her for 9 hours after arresting her yesterday, but put no allegations to her of any crime. As for appearing before a parliamentary committee tomorrow, and by the way, all eyes are now on that committee hearing, he said that Brooks is willing to attend, but it's up to the committee and parliament to decide whether to go ahead or to postpone her appearance.
Okay, thanks so much, Phil.
You're welcome.
That's the latest from London from NPR's Philip Reeves. And one more update to this story. The number two at Scotland Yard, John Yates, also submitted his resignation this morning.
The U.S. military recently captured a Somali man and interrogated him for more than 2 months on board a Navy ship. Then this month, they flew him to New York and indicted him on federal charges. The case is reigniting debate over whether to prosecute terrorism cases in civilian court and over what rights terror suspects really have. Those are questions we have considered at length on this program.
But we rarely have the chance to explore them with someone who has actually interrogated one of those suspects. That was the job of Glenn Coral. He's a former CIA spy, and he was assigned back in 2002 to lead the interrogation of a suspected senior member of Al-Qaeda. Coral's written a book about the experience. It's called The Interrogator. He told us how he first got the assignment.
First, I was approached and asked if I could go on what we call a TDY, but that's a business trip for 30 or 60 days, that it was very important for the agency, for the country, and for me. Could I go? And so the answer, of course, to that is yes. And one suspects in 2002 that it would be related to the war on terror. And then I went for the briefing and was told we've captured one of the top members of Al-Qaeda. We think he might be able to lead us to bin Laden. If not, certainly he can help us seriously damage the institution. And you will do whatever it takes to get him to talk.
Were you told that anything was off the table during these interrogations?
The short answer to that is no. It was always just pressure him. And I was in the early days of the interrogation program. So the protocols and guidelines that are quite clear that I am able to put in the book didn't exist at the time. And when I was told, you will do whatever it takes, my response was, well, we don't do that. And then the rejoinder was, we do now.
Now, in terms of explaining who it was that you were sent to interrogate and what it was you were supposed to try to get from him, we should be clear, you are still not allowed to say his name, his nationality, where you were interrogating him, what he was accused of doing, or even what language you were going to be interrogating him in.
That's all correct. I was surprised that they redacted, or which is the term of art for censored, of course, the language I speak, because it's easily discoverable, and I didn't think that it was sensitive, but they took that out even.
You eventually interrogated him in two different sites, first in a host country, which you're not allowed to name, and then in one of the CIA black sites overseas. You were being told, do whatever it takes, pressure him, but your instinct was that physical abuse would be counterproductive, that you were going to have to build some sort of rapport.
Well, I'd go further than that even. There was no question to me from the first instant that I would ever do or be involved in anything physical. I simply wouldn't. It's just whatever my orders, that was just clear to me. However, there are psychological measures that I had been subject to. It is part of my training. And we'd been taught that psychological manipulation was not lasting or severe. That's the definition of what would be unacceptable treatment, and did have an effect. I concluded pretty quickly that that was wrong and came to oppose that too.
Did this detainee ever provide useful intelligence?
Oh, he did. This is one of the gray areas in the whole case. He did have contact with people of interest in Al-Qaeda. And he did have information that was what we would call disseminable. It passed the threshold of useful information to be sent to policymakers. He didn't have, I believe, or at least didn't provide, the critical information or have the intimate, active, conscious, willing links and associations with Al-Qaeda that we had assessed him to have before.
And you came, over the course of the many hours you spent with him, to believe that the CIA had gotten it wrong, that this man was not, in fact, a dangerous jihadist. He wasn't even a member of Al-Qaeda, you didn't think.
Well, I'm confident that he wasn't a member of Al-Qaeda, and he wasn't dangerous. Now, did his work facilitate some Al-Qaeda activities? You could argue that it did, but I try to give an analogy of a ticket conductor in Grand Central Station. And if you sell a ticket to a member of Al-Qaeda going to Long Island, are you aiding and abetting? I think that's a long stretch to make, and I think that Captus was in that
Captus
situation.
Captus is the name that you give
that's
to him.
That's right.
In the book.
I'm sorry. The detainee, whom I called dubbed Captus in the book. It gets a little more complex, though. He wasn't, I believe, a total innocent. So there were things he couldn't avoid doing, things he knew, some things he didn't want to tell me, some things he did and didn't know the consequences of.
When you concluded that this man was not who the CIA believed he was, you concluded that he should be released, you wrote two cables, two pretty strongly worded communications back to agency headquarters here in Washington, telling them that. What happened?
Well, I did. There were the two strongest cables I ever wrote, but I found when I arrived back in Washington that no one knew of their existence, and they seemed never to have been sent.
Why do you think that was?
Well, I think that they were impolitic and upset the apple cart, and they challenged the premises of the specific operation and the methods being used, and they placed in question years of work by very talented people. They challenged, in a larger context, actually, much of the approach taken in the war on terror and the rendition, detention, and interrogation programs. And so it was a gadfly avoided if the cables didn't go.
You know, I was struck by your description in the book of the CIA, like any big bureaucracy, very difficult to stop once the train is in motion. And it's interesting, you, as the person on the front lines carrying out the interrogation, having grave doubts about the way that it was unfolding, how difficult it was for you to challenge the policy being made back in Washington.
Well, I was deeply disturbed by what I found, and I'm one of the few people to have been involved in these processes that the American people believe were necessary on the whole, were necessary to protect us. And I enthusiastically gave my best to try to serve and oppose al-Qaeda and help protect us and accomplish my mission. But Americans need to know what we have done to ourselves out of sight. We have coarsened ourselves and weakened our laws. And I think what we did is not at all what I took an oath to serve.
Glenn Carl, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Glenn Carl is the author of The Interrogator, An Education. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
As Space Shuttle Atlantis orbits the Earth on NASA's last shuttle mission, it's worth remembering that this high-tech spaceship is also, in many ways, homemade. 5 years ago, we introduced you to a few of the workers who made key parts of NASA's shuttles by hand. They used everyday tools like sewing needles and X-Acto knives. Now that the shuttle program is ending, NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce decided to revisit those people, see how their lives have changed now that the shuttles no longer need them.
When my colleague David Kestenbaum visited Florida's Kennedy Space Center back in 2006, he walked into a factory-like room. There, he saw women sewing what looked like small, white, quilted blankets. They were thermal blankets, part of the heat shield that protects the shuttle during its fiery reentry. One of the workers was Teresa Haygood.
What are you doing there?
I'm threading a bobbin.
Is it special thread?
Oh, yeah. Made out of glass.
Made out of glass?
Mm-hmm. Everything we have in here is made out of glass.
With the glass thread, she could sew heat-resistant cloth into precise shapes that would fit onto the shuttle like pieces of an elaborate jigsaw puzzle. But when I went to Florida a few weeks ago, I couldn't meet up with Teresa Haygood at the Space Center. She left that job last year. She says it was clear that the days of shuttle making were coming to an end.
Well, the timing was right for me for things going on in my family and my life, and so I just went ahead and took one of the early layoffs.
I met her in the town of Titusville, which is right across the Indian River from the Space Center. We stood on a pier and looked across the water. In the distance, we could see the big vehicle assembly building where NASA used to put its shuttles together. Haygood remembers her old job as being both challenging and meaningful.
When you're making something for flight, you know, you're always thinking about the, you know, the people that this is going to protect. And so you're really very conscious of how you're making it and your measurements and everything, because you know that you might have somebody's life in your hand.
The job used skills she'd been perfecting since she was a child.
I kind of taught myself, and I'd follow my grandmother around and bug her for needle and thread all the time. She got tired of it, but I started out making Barbie clothes, and then I found out making people clothes was a lot easier, so I just went from there.
To tailoring, upholstery, drapes, and eventually to the job that took sewing to the level of rocket science. Her father had worked for the Apollo program. Haygood applied and reapplied until the space shuttle program finally hired her. She stayed there for more than 8 years. Haygood says she's been looking for jobs online, even at jobs in other states. It's a tough job market, especially around the Space Center.
There's always things that I can do. I always find something to do. I can always take care of myself. I'm not worried about it, really.
The building where Haygood used to work is called the Thermal Protection System Facility. Its rooms are still full of equipment, not just old sewing machines, but things like ovens for baking space shuttle tiles. The manager here is Martin Wilson. He's with a NASA contractor called United Space Alliance. When he gave NPR a tour 5 years ago, about 100 people worked here. Now there's only half that.
And we'll be going down to just 20 after July.
So from 50 to 20?
Yes, from 50 to 20.
The early layoffs were mostly voluntary buyouts, like Teresa Haygood's, but not these last ones.
Some of these folks have been with us a very, very long time. A huge number have been here over 20 years, and they're extremely good at what they do. These are people who've spent the majority of their careers working towards something that now simply is going away through no fault of their own.
Wilson has been here for over 2 decades himself, and says he'll stick around for, quote, as long as they will let him. He worries that as people go, so will all their knowledge and experience, making it harder to create heat shields for any future spaceships.
What we do is anything but mainstream. I mean, there are simply not thermal protection system manufacturers, down every high street in the country. If we're going to maintain a manned spaceflight program, we are going to need the skills that we have in this building.
One worker who's been told he can stay in the building is Damon Petty. When we last met him, 5 years ago, he was putting tape on a shuttle tile, getting ready to apply a special coating. He still does that kind of work.
I'm just so happened to be one of the lucky ones, I guess, to hang around.
He's not sure exactly what heat shields he'll be working on next. NASA is developing a new space capsule. That will need tiles. And there may be work to do for commercial space companies.
Whatever they need to be done, hopefully I can be a part of it.
He says after 22 years, it still thrilled him to know that shuttle tiles he helped make went up into space.
It's just amazing that, you know, it's been in the orbit and it returns. And, hey, I'm proud to say I did that.
He says he won't just miss the shuttles, but also his coworkers.
Coming into work and not seeing those faces and the experience and talent that was in this building is going to be different. It's going to really have a big effect.
Do you know folks who have already left? Have they been able to find stuff to do?
No, I'm not sure. I know of a few that's relocated, moved out of the state, that's gotten jobs. But around here, I really don't know of many that has jobs around this area still.
My last day will be July the 22nd.
When NPR first spoke with Betty Smith, she was working in the sewing room. The day I visited, she was still there, stitching a spare part in case Atlantis needed to be repaired before launch. Smith has worked here for over 21 years. She hopes to go back to school, maybe do something in the medical field.
I'm not quite old enough to retire, so I'm still going to have to go in a different direction, I guess. But it's doable, it's possible. There's life after the Space Center. There really is.
But there's also a sadness.
The shuttle fleets, you know, the shuttles that we have helped build, they've been a part of our lives for so long, so it's personal to us. And just the fact that it's all going away is just like, I don't know, losing your kid. You know, your kid moving away to college, and you know they're gone, and things are never going to be the same. I think things won't be the same, you know, without looking up and seeing a shuttle go off. It just won't be the same.
She says it feels like a great loss, not just for her and all the other people who have built the space shuttles, but for the whole country. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Finally, you might have been following the growing scandal in Britain over the sleazy techniques allegedly used by some tabloid journalists to get information on people. Apparently, no one was spared. The journalists, and I use that term reluctantly, worked for outlets owned by Rupert Murdoch, who also owns Fox News. They allegedly paid off police and tricked their way into people's voicemail and other accounts. They targeted celebrities, of course, but also a murder victim and families of soldiers killed in conflicts overseas. 10 people have been arrested so far, including a top former News Corp executive named Rebecca Brooks, who was or is a close confidant of Britain's Prime Minister David Cameron. But here in the U.S., in part because of the Fox News connection, there are obvious questions about whether similar conduct took place here and, of course, about Rupert Murdoch. What did he know? And if he did, when did he know it? Murdoch, of course, is as much a friend to right-leaning politicians in this country as he is in the UK. So one can understand why someone he has supported, like former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, who Murdoch endorsed for mayor in 1993 and was a guest at his 2003 wedding, was quick to jump to Murdoch's defense. At a meeting with voters in New Hampshire last week, where Giuliani was testing the waters for another presidential bid, the former mayor said he didn't believe his friend could have had anything to do with the scandal. "Give people the presumption of innocence," Mr. Giuliani said. "Can I just tell you, I am all for that program. Too bad Mr. Giuliani didn't offer that same consideration to the unarmed man named Patrick Doris Mond, who was shot to death by an undercover New York City police officer when that officer asked Doris Mond where he could buy drugs. And Mr. Doris Mond, a security guard and father of two, told him to get lost. Mr. Giuliani could have said, what a terrible tragedy. And he could have said, let's take a hard look at this and see where the facts lead. And he could have said, let's give people the presumption of innocence. But he didn't. What he did was release Mr. Doris Mond's sealed juvenile record for the purpose, he said, of showing that the young man was not an altar boy. Except that Mr. Doris Mond had gone to the same Catholic high school as the mayor, where, according to one account, he was, in fact, an altar boy. That probably factored into the city's decision to pay his family more than $2 million to settle the wrongful death lawsuit that followed. Here's the point. If the rich and powerful deserve the presumption of innocence, and they do, then so do the poor and unpopular. But too often, the people least likely to benefit from that presumption are the people who need it most, the people who are least likely to have the means to protect their rights and reputations. The prosecution of international banker Dominique Strauss-Kahn, which seems to be crumbling, is being used as an object lesson on the presumption of innocence. A better example might be the one told in a new book called The Central Park Five by writer and filmmaker Sarah Burns. Burns recounts the horrifying story of five Black and Latino teenagers who were wrongly convicted in connection with one of New York's most gruesome and terrifying crimes of the late 1980s, the so-called Central Park Wilding case. A young woman was viciously beaten, raped, and left for dead when she went for an evening jog in Central Park. Within days, five teenagers were arrested, interrogated for hours without their parents, and tried as adults. They were quickly convicted, even though there was no DNA evidence and no eyewitness accounts tied them to the crime. They served their complete sentences of more than 10 years each before another man confessed to committing the crime and his role was corroborated. That's half a century of lives wasted. It's easy to see why we react the way we do to different crimes. Street crime is so much easier to understand on a visceral level than corporate crime. The people who commit street crime often don't look like the rest of us or act like us or wear nice clothes. They don't have political favors to hand out. But it's worth remembering that the measure of a justice system worthy of its name is not just whether a man with one of the world's biggest megaphones is treated fairly, but how that system treats those with no voice at all. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. More than 40 million Americans care for an elderly or disabled loved one. Today, a new study by the AARP estimates the value of their work at $450 billion per year. That is a good deal for society, but it can be hard on the family members doing the work. The study finds they need a lot more help. Here's NPR's Jennifer Ludden.
Simondo Henley's mother was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis as he was starting college. She's now wheelchair-bound, and Henley, 36, has been taking care of her for nearly two decades.
A little bit more, some little bit more. Right there is good.
He rubs a prescription cream under her right knee. It helps with severe hot flashes and loosens her joints.
You know, I've had to give her injections before and that kind of stuff. This is much easier.
Henley does have help. Montgomery County, Maryland, where they live, and the MS Society pay for 35 hours of home health aides each week, though that's threatened by budget cuts. But every day, Henley must help his mom in and out of bed, onto the toilet. He even rolls her over in the middle of the night if she becomes uncomfortable. Care like this from a professional can cost tens of thousands a year. But Henley does it for free, of course, and on top of his full-time job. The AARP study finds family members spend an average 20 hours a week providing care. Henley refuses to count, but his mom, Vicky, keeps tab.
Simondo's care for me was about 40 hours a week.
That's like another full-time job.
Yes.
Modern medicine now allows people to manage chronic conditions for decades, but the AARP study finds increasingly complicated procedures are routinely expected of family caregivers. Henley remembers the time his mom was being discharged from the hospital. She had a catheter in, and the nurse said, "Oh, we'll call you and tell you how to take it out over the phone."
And I said, "Oh, no, you will not." I'm like, "Really? This is my mother."
The burden on families is huge.
Lynn Feinberg co-authored the AARP study. She says modern family caregiving is incredibly stressful.
While families are stepping up to the plate and provide this contribution to society, the costs to their own health and financial security is huge.
The study finds those who cut back work lose hundreds of thousands of dollars in income over a lifetime. Feinberg says caregivers are also more prone to depression, to physical ailments, and social isolation.
They will burn out, they will get sick, and there will be no other option but to place someone in a nursing home, which is what nobody wants.
And if the burden for caregivers seems big now, Suzanne Mintz of the National Family Caregivers Association says it's only going to get worse as the baby boom generation enters old age.
Boomers have fewer kids than their parents did, and they're working, and they don't necessarily live around the corner anymore.
On top of this, there's a shortage of paid home health aides. Last week, the Obama administration joined labor groups calling for the creation of 2 million more jobs in home health care, plus a new visa for immigrants willing to enter the field. Suzanne Mintz has grappled with the problem in caring for her husband, who has MS. Earlier this year, she had trouble finding someone to change his catheter twice a week while she was at work. So she says she resorted to something a little crazy.
With Stephen's permission, I actually put a note on the neighborhood listserv.
A little different than watering the flowers?
Yeah, right.
Sure enough, a man who works from home said he'd be willing to try it. He's been doing it ever since, for free. Mintz says we need to expand our definition of family. Next year, she plans to launch a recruitment drive to match those in need with volunteers.
It might be, I can drive her to PT for the next 5 Thursdays, or I can bring meals for the next 6 months.
In other words, create a community of caregivers, an old idea, really, for a new age. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.